time it is. It's time for Ask a Spaceman. I'm your host, Paul Sutter. You've got questions and I've got answers. You know how this show works, but let's ring around another time. You go online to Twitter or Facebook, use the hashtag Ask a Spaceman, send me your questions and I will attempt, I'll do my best to answer them. You can also follow me on Twitter and Facebook. My handle is at Paul Matt Sutter. You can also ask a spaceman at gmail.com. Also visit the YouTube page, youtube.com/C/Paul Matt Sutter. That channel, by the way, doesn't have just videos of me answering science questions. There's a lot of other cool content that I think you should check out. We have a very simple goal with this show. Complete knowledge of time and space. And on the road to complete knowledge of time and space, we're going to visit Iceland. That's right, we're going on an astro tour to hunt aurora. Go to astrotouring.com to check out the trip. It's going to be really, really fun. And we're going to have fun and do science together, okay? Now, on the road, the real road to complete knowledge of time and space, we have a question from Jamal, an email asking, what's up with Saturn's rings? That's a very good, very to-the-point kind of question that I like. We got something up there. There's some rings around Saturn. How did that be a thing? Well, before I get into the discussion of Saturn's rings, I'm going to be honest. We don't understand most things about the universe. We just straight up don't understand most things about the universe. But that doesn't always mean that we're wallowing in ignorance. And it also doesn't mean that all bets are off when it comes to our understanding of the universe. To me, there are two basic kinds of mysteries in the universe. There's mysteries that if we solve them, it will unveil new physics, like dark energy. We don't understand dark energy. If we ever figure out what dark energy is, that will usher in a new understanding. It'll really push the boundary of physics. Our current physics simply can't explain dark energy. But then there's also a lot of other kind of more mundane mysteries that if we solve them, it'll just be a nice check mark. But it's not like we think it will lead to a new understanding of the fundamental workings of the universe. And there's also layers to our understanding, or layers to our ignorance. We can look at a physical system and say, yeah, we kind of get the basic principles of what's going on. We know we're on the right track, but it's super complicated. It's really messy. Or we can say, we have a model of this scenario. It's a little bit unsatisfactory, but we're pretty sure we're on the right track. Or we could say we have a couple competing models that are both very plausible, but we just don't have enough evidence yet to tip the balance to favor one model over the other. And that's actually the state of, I would say, almost all astronomy. Once you start digging down into the details, how does this process work? How did this situation arise? How many of these are there? We don't really fully 100% nail it down, understand it, but that doesn't mean we don't know what's going on. We have a pretty basic picture and there are some inadequacies, and that's just the way astronomy is. That's just the way science is, really. But it's a good question to ask if there's all these mysteries, and especially when it's not mysteries that are going to lead to brand new physics. We're not going to shake the foundations of cosmology or astrophysics or anything like that. There's all these mysteries. It's just quote unquote known physics. We just don't know exactly how it's applied in this particular situation. Why do these mysteries persist? Why can't we just, you know, solve it? Well, to be honest, in some cases, we need to wait for better observations. We just don't have enough data to rule out one model or another, or give us a clue of the kinds of physical processes that need to be involved in the scenario. We just need to wait for more data. And also, you know what? There are fashion trends in science. There are hot topics. There are things that a lot of people in the community like to think about, like to work on, like to write papers on, like to host conferences on. And then 5 years, 10 years later, it's not so exciting anymore. It didn't stop being exciting because we solved the problem. We're just moving on to the next thing. It's just, you know, we're not so much interested in it anymore, and that's life. I'm giving this long preface because, you know what? We don't fully understand Saturn's rings. But we don't think that if we were to fully understand Saturn's rings, it would revolutionize physics. It wouldn't completely change our understanding of how the solar system forms. We don't need to introduce new exotic particles beyond the standard model to explain Saturn's rings. The truth is, Saturn's rings are a really complicated, messy place, and we simply don't have good enough data to favor one model or theory over another, or to really point us in a new direction to tell us what kind of physics are involved in the formation of Saturn's rings. And we've been chipping away at Saturn's rings, this problem of Saturn's rings, for hundreds of years. It's actually one of the longest standing open questions in astronomy. The first person to spot Saturn's rings was Galileo when he took his nice fancy telescope, pointed it up at the sky, saw all sorts of really cool stuff, which I need to do an episode. But you guys need to ask if you want the episode just on Galileo, feel free, shoot that email, ask me about Galileo, and I'll answer it when I feel like it, which would be sometime in the future. Anyway, he saw them, but his telescope wasn't, he was really great and revolutionary, but it wasn't all that great. He actually couldn't see the rings themselves. He just saw fuzzy lumps on either side of the planet. And the lumps would get smaller and smaller. They get thinner and thinner, and they'd disappear. And then they'd reappear, get thicker and thicker, and they'd look like nice, proper, lumpy lumps again, and they'd disappear. Now we know that he was looking at the disk, and depending on our view of the disk, sometimes we see it edge on, sometimes we see it a little bit more face on, we see a little bit more fleshed out, just on where we are in the solar system relative to Saturn. But Galileo, he didn't know that, and he was totally stumped. He was flabbergasted. He was nonplussed. He really didn't know what the heck was going on with Saturn. Remember, the telescope was brand spanking new. Imagine never hearing about, say, microbes or bacteria and looking through a microscope for the first time. You would see this amazingly complex world revealed to you. What the is going on? And that was kind of the reaction that Galileo had to looking at Saturn. Yeah, he sees the surface of the moon. Wow, that's really crazy. He sees phases of Venus. Wow, that's really crazy, but pretty cool. I can understand that. He sees moons of Jupiter. Wow, that's pretty crazy, but cool. I can understand. He sees these weird fuzzy lumps on Saturn that kind of disappear. What is going on? Over the course of hundreds of years, we steadily learned more and more about the rings of Saturn. First, as telescopes got more powerful, we realized they weren't blobs, they were a disk. Then telescopes got even more powerful, we realized they're not disks, they're rings. And then we were actually able to visit them with our space probes, and now they're back to being a disk again. They're not really rings. I'll get there, don't worry. But it's interesting to look at the Titans that were involved in studying Saturn over the centuries. Huygens, Hooke, Cassini, Laplace, Maxwell. Maxwell! If James Clerk Maxwell is studying your problem, you know it's a big problem, because he's no lightweight. There were serious, serious people that were drawn to the study of Saturn's rings. And the names that we give, now that we know that the rings have lots of divisions and sub-rings, smaller rings, things like that, the names we give to the parts of Saturn's rings are a perfect illustration of how we've steadily chipped away at our understanding of the problem, of how they got there. And this is also an excellent example of how astronomy ends up with so many horrible naming conventions that make no sense whatsoever. This is a perfect example. First, we'll start with one big ring, like a disc. And it's just called the ring, or the disc. It's the thing that Saturn has. Then Cassini, the astronomer, not the space probe. Cassini found a gap. There's a thin gap between the two rings. There's two rings now. There's not just one. There's two of them. Let's call the outside one A and the inside one B. So Saturn has two rings, an A ring on the outside and a B ring on the inside. Sure, I can roll with that. Let's do it. Then in 1850, we found an fainter, with an even better telescope, we found an inner ring that was very, very faint. Apparently, originally, it's hard to track down a real source for this. Apparently, it was called the crepe ring because it looked like a very thin, you know, pancake, like a crepe. But eventually, hey, we're not allowed to have fun in astronomy, so we're going to call it C. We're going to call it the C ring. Okay, so that's not so bad. So on the outside, we have A. In the middle, we have B. And on the inside, we have C, or opposite CBA going inside to out. And now that's it stuck like that for over 100 years. And then Voyager visited Saturn and found a faint ring inside the C ring going almost to the very edge of the atmosphere. That's pretty cool. Hey, we seem to be on a roll. We keep finding inner and inner more and more rings. We'll call it D, the D ring. The D ring sits on the innermost sides, and then you have the C ring and then the B ring. And at the very edge, you have the A ring. Then, after some more detailed observations, we find a very faint ring outside the furthest A ring. Shoot. We had such a good thing going. What do we call it? The zero ring? The negative A ring? That doesn't make sense. Well, the next letter is E. We've got A, B, C, D. The next letter is E, but it won't be in order anymore because it'll be further away than the A ring. But okay. We'll just make a special exception just this once. We're going to have from inside to outside, D, C, B, A, E. Okay. But then we found a ring outside the A ring, but inside the E ring. F it. F ring. Just call it the F ring. Just... And then we found a ring between F and E, and just we're just going to call it G. So the order we have for the rings of Saturn going from inside to outside is D, C, B, A, F, G, E. Or going from outside in, E, G, F, A, B, C, D. Because of our history of observations, and no one wanted to rename the A ring to something better that would make more sense, we decided to stick with the original names, but just add more names in this totally nonsensical manner. Fine. Whatever. We're done. We've got these seven rings. They're labeled a little bit funky, but, you know, we can live with it. Then Cassini, the space probe, not the astronomer, visits Saturn and takes a lot more high detailed observations, high resolution pictures, some more studies, and then it just goes crazy. Now we've got the Janus ring, the Anthe ring, the Phoebe ring, the Pellene ring, the Roche division, the Colombo gap, the Maxwell ringlet, the Dawes gap, the Huygens ringlet, the Laplace gap, the Titan ringlet, on and on and on. We see rings within rings and gaps within gaps. We see rings within gaps and gaps within rings. Rings, it turns out, what we used to think of as a ring, turns out they have a lot of gaps. It turns out the gaps aren't so gappy after all. The higher resolution cameras we get trained onto Saturn's rings, the smaller the scale of rings and gaps that we get to see. In fact, the C ring, the ring that we called the C ring, and the gap, the division that we call the Cassini division, look pretty much the same. They're both a mix of gaps and rings, but just because of history, one gets called a ring and the other gets called a division. So it's best to just stop thinking about rings. Stop thinking about the rings of Saturn. You're just going to get sick to your stomach. It's better to think of it again as a disc. A disc of glitter, where the glitter are clumps of water ice, anywhere from the size of a grain of dust to a pebble, all the way up to the size of a boulder. And there's a few trace elements here and there to add some nice color. Think of it like a flat, thin, broad disc of glitter. Like if you spilled glitter on a countertop and kind of shaped it into be a little circle shape. That's kind of what we're thinking. But there are places where there's more or less glitter than average, and I'll get to why in a bit. This gives us the appearance of distinct rings. There's just pieces, parts of it, where there's more glitter than average. So from far away, from a telescope on the Earth, or even from a space probe orbiting the planet Saturn, it looks like it's a distinct ring. But really, it's all, there's junk everywhere. I shouldn't call it junk. I should call it glitter. And disks, thinking of it like a disk is actually really handy. Because disks are all over the place. We've met disks before in our conversations, and we'll meet disks again. Active galactic nuclei, disk. Galaxies, disk. Solar systems, disks. Disks are all over the place. Nature is really, really good at making disks. So it's actually better to look at the problem of Saturn's rings, of basically how they get there, from the perspective of a disk rather than perspective of a set of rings, because the rings are actually kind of an illusion. It's more like a disk. And Saturn isn't alone in having a disk. It turns out all giant planets have them. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune all have a faint little disk. Why? Because these massive planets are spinning fast enough that they're a little bit fatter around the middle. And this asymmetry, the fact that they're a little fatter around the middle, makes the gravity in the plane of their equator just a little bit stronger than average. Just, you just work out the math of what a planet that's spinning and it's a little bit fatter around its middle, what its gravitational field looks like. And because of that slightly strong gravity, it's not much, but that slightly strong gravity, it can trap particles in the plane of that equator. And all the giant planets are fat enough to do this. And some even objects in the distant solar system that aren't so big are able to form these little disks. We see evidence of rings or disks around very small objects in the outer solar system. We see these because, well, there's all sorts of junk and gunk floating around the solar system. But most junk and gunk just isn't bright. It's made of dust, and dust ain't so bright. But in the outer edge of the solar system, beyond what we call the frost line, water can stay frozen. And water is super common. Frozen water is even more common. And it's nice and glittery. It's shiny. It lights up. It looks like glitter. So when these big planets gravitationally attract a bunch of dust and gunk, they also attract a bunch of ice water, and we happen to see the ice water really, really well. And so this can happen around the giant planets, can also happen around smaller planets. If you ever happen to see a sci-fi show where there's an Earth-like planet, and it's all nice and warm, and they have liquid water on the surface, but then a ring or a disk around it, that's very, very implausible. Of course, I don't want to say impossible, but it's incredibly implausible to have liquid water on the surface of a planet and then frozen water orbiting it. It's just not how it works. So rings or disks are super easy to form. You just need stuff in a solar system, and then you need something that's spinning. So it's a little bit fatter around the middle, and its gravitational field, its gravitational force is a little bit stronger in the plane of its equator. Voila, disk. So it's not the question, why did Saturn get a disk? Why did Saturn get a big disk? And this brings us to the big debate about Saturn's rings. And by the way, I'm going to interchange the word ring and disk this entire episode just to confuse you as much as possible. FYI. The big debate about Saturn's rings, aka Saturn's disk, is, are they young or old? Have they been around for basically forever? Or did we just happen to get lucky and be able to observe Saturn when it has this temporary, beautiful ring or disk system. And I'll get to the various scenarios for forming Saturn's rings in a bit, but first I want to get across that we do know that the rings are dynamic and constantly evolving. Just like the disks in other systems, there are wobbles, wibbles, instabilities, waves. There's complicated physics, multiple kinds of interactions that influence and shape the formation and evolution of that disk, just like any other disk we see in the universe. In fact, the same kind of waves that give spiral galaxies their distinct spirals appear in the rings of Saturn. So we see spiral density waves in the rings of Saturn, just like we see spiral density waves in the disk of a galaxy. And small moons that happen to be embedded in that disk can open up gaps the exact same way that a young planet can clear a gap in a protoplanetary disk. I talked about this a little bit when I did the episode on exoplanets. I talked about hot Jupiters. And this is why thinking of Saturn's rings as a disk is so useful, because there's all these other examples that we can draw from, and we can learn about the physics in this disk that appears in a totally different scenario and apply very similar physics to try to explain what's happening in Saturn's rings. And how gaps open is really cool. If you happen to put a moon in a disk, or if you happen to put a planet in a protoplanetary disk, you would think that the gravity of that planet would just glob stuff onto it, you know, sucking down material, and that's how it'd clear the gap. And some of that does happen, but paradoxically, a very wide gap opens because the moon in Saturn's rings, and there are some moons embedded in Saturn's rings, actually push stuff away. It appears paradoxical, but it's important to remember that everything in this disk is in orbit around Saturn. So everything's moving. Stuff that's further away is orbiting at a slower speed than stuff that's orbiting closer. So if you have the moon, there's disk material, bits of ice, that are in an orbit further away, and they're orbiting slower, and there's parts of the disk that are closer to it, and that stuff is orbiting faster. As the moon goes whizzing by, doing its thing, say there's a bit of ice that's in an orbit outside of it, gets pulled not just down or inwards towards the planet, it also gets pulled forward. It's pulled forward, it's get a little tug. And that action actually ends up giving it an even bigger orbit, like tugging on a leash. Like as the planet goes by, if there's something in an orbit further away than Saturn, than that little moon, it tugs on it actually tugs it out into a further orbit. In reverse, for a bit of ice or a piece of the disk or ring that's inside the orbit of the moon. So as the moon forms, either gets dropped in through orbital motions or just naturally forms, it's going to repel parts of the disk and open up a gap that's much, much wider than the planet or moon itself. And so we think that's how some of the gaps and divisions formed. And even if a moon isn't embedded in the disk, it's not embedded in the rings, it can still influence the motions of the particles that make up the rings. For example, the Cassini division, the big division between the A and B rings, that orbit actually happens to be in a particular resonance with the moon Mimas, where any stuff that happens to be in that part of the ring orbits twice for every one orbit of Mimas that's further out. So Mimas gets to do an extra little gravitational tug every other orbit for these little ring particles gets a little tug from Mimas, a little tug, a little tug, a little tug. And over the course of millions of years, it tugs that stuff away and a gap actually opens up. And this is the big Cassini division. Also, there's actions, our old friends, the spiral density waves, which give us these beautiful spiral arms and galaxies. Those act inside of rings and actually act to clear out gaps too. Now, we do know that inside the Cassini division, there are many more ringlets with small, tiny gaps in between them. We're not exactly sure how that works, but that's life. We do know that the E-ring is actually fed by the moon Enceladus. Enceladus is actually ejecting material, ejecting water and water ice from its subterranean ocean, or I should say subsurface ocean. We're not exactly sure how that works, but that's life. The F ring is very, very, very thin. It's kept in a nice, tight, thin line, and it's also twisted up like a braid. It looks super cool when you look at these photographs. And that's done by the actions of the moons Prometheus and Pandora. They're kind of shepherding that ring. We're not exactly sure how that works, but that's life. But we do know that the moons of Saturn do shape and influence the behavior of the rings. We're not just exactly sure on the details. It's much more complicated. We have a very rough picture. There are rings, ringlets, there are small gaps, there are wider divisions. Somehow the moons of Saturn shape the behavior of these rings. But there are arcs, there are partial rings. There are multiple small gaps within divisions. The F ring itself is completely crazy. There's these two moons, Janus and Epimetheus, that swap places every 4 years. There are spokes. There are these, the most interesting little thing on the rings, you see these spokes radiating out from the rings. We think those might be almost a static or electromagnetic interaction, where just dust particles get suspended above the disk or the plane of the rings. We're not exactly sure how that works. Here's a real quote from a paper in talking about the ringlet that happens to share an orbit with the moon Pan in one of the gaps. The ringlet is described as, quote, kinky and clumpy. That's life. The D-ring, good old D-ring, varies in brightness. It varies in brightness. It was last perturbed. We think it varies in brightness because it was perturbed in 1983. 1983, not millions of years ago, not even thousands of years ago. In 1983, something, quote unquote, something happened to Saturn to make the D-ring start varying in brightness. There's so much of the rings that we just don't understand. But we know the fundamental physics that's happening. It's just gravity with like a little dash of chemistry and a little dash of electromagnetics. But it's such a complicated, messy place. It's hard to tease out exactly what's going on and explain every single feature of the rings. It's a complicated, messy, and fascinating place. But still, there's this big question, not just the dynamics, like how are the rings operating, but when did they form? How old are the rings of Saturn? It appears to be a paradox. And we have evidence that points in the direction of the rings being very young. And we have evidence pointing in the direction that the rings are very, very old. The evidence for the rings being very young is that they are almost entirely pure water ice. That's how they're so shiny. That's how we get to see them from Earth. But the solar system, like I said, is a dusty place with micrometeorites floating all around doing things. They would get that disk really dirty. They would coat it with a layer of dust in just a few hundred million years. And yes, in astronomy, a few hundred million years is a very, very young thing. They shouldn't be so shiny. How'd they get clean? Also, the fact that some of these ring particles are the size of pebbles or boulders, if they're packed in kind of tight, they're constantly jostling up against each other, pulverizing each other, we shouldn't see large stuff anymore. It should all be tiny stuff just from countless collisions and collisions and collisions. It should just be pulverized. And also, when we study the interactions between rings and moons and moonlets, little tiny objects that aren't quite moons embedded in the rings, and we work the simulations looking at how these gravitationally interact, they only are able to stay stable for about, 10 million years or so. Eventually, just because of all the countless interactions, gravitationally, dynamically, they just fall apart. So that's one line of thought that points to the rings of Saturn being relatively young. And we just happen to be lucky to see them at this time. But there's some lines of evidence that say Saturn's rings are very, very old. The number one thing is, where did all that stuff come from? The total mass of all the stuff in the rings is something like another moon. It's about the size of, about the mass of Mimas, which is a proper moon. If the rings are only a few million years old, there's not that much stuff in the outer parts of the solar system anymore. The only way to get that much stuff in orbit around Saturn is if it came with Saturn. If it was a package deal, if you get a Saturn, you get all its junk too. And that can only happen in the early days of the solar system. All that material is like a shredded up moon. A moon that tried to form but got within what we call the Roche limit, where the gravitational stretching and bending forces just from the planet itself are enough to overwhelm the moon or the object from being able to hold itself together. So it literally gets shredded up, stretched out, and torn apart. All that material in the rings are within the Roche limit of a potential moon. So maybe a moon tried to form with Saturn and then got shredded up. But if Saturn's rings formed from a shredded up moon, moons aren't just made of water ice. They're also made of dust. So where'd all the dust go? We only see the water ice. What happened to that dust that if it was a moon that got shredded up, the moon is part water ice and part dust, and it got torn apart, what happened to all the dust? Why is it only ice? So what's going on? Well, we don't know. Maybe, hear me out, maybe it's both. Maybe the material is old because the only way to get that much stuff in orbit around Saturn is it to be come from the very early solar system. Maybe the structure is young. Maybe the particular arrangement of rings that we see today is relatively young. Maybe it used to be a mix of rocky and icy stuff, dusty bits and icy bits. Maybe the rocky bits kept accreting, kept pulling stuff on. Maybe they became a moonlet and then got ejected. And then as new moonlets form, they shaped the remaining ring material, and there's this kind of process that happens over the course of hundreds of millions of years. Maybe there's some sort of recycling mechanism to clean the ice so that as dust accumulates, maybe they collide with each other and heat up, and then the dust evaporates. I don't know. We're spitballing here. So it kind of keeps clean and also keeps it clumpy, where the ice is able to glue together to form things like pebbles and boulders without just getting pulverized. Maybe the rings always look young because the structure is constantly evolving, but the base material, the raw stuff that goes into making the rings, was seeded billions of years ago in the formation of the solar system. But it's constantly changing. It's constantly evolving. There's moonlets and moons and rings. And sometimes maybe it's more clumpy. Maybe sometimes it's more dispersed. Sometimes maybe it's a bigger orbit and then it shrinks back down. Maybe the rings change in brightness and density. We don't know. All models of rings of Saturn have their weaknesses. They're not able to explain and account for all observations. Just like disks in other scenarios, we don't fully understand the disks that lead to solar system. We don't fully understand the evolution of galaxy disks. We don't fully understand active galactic nuclei disks. The physics are very, very messy. So Saturn's in a very good place. It's in good company. So why do we keep studying it? If we know that if we're able to crack the case of the age and evolution and properties of Saturn's rings, it wouldn't lead to any new physics. We're not going to have any breakthrough announcements. No Nobel Prizes are going to be awarded to the person or people who figure out how old Saturn's rings are and how they operate. So why do we do it? Well, I don't quote people much in this show. And I certainly don't quote people at length like I'm about to do. But if I'm going to do it, it might as well be James Clerk Maxwell. Because Maxwell, my bud, was studying Saturn's rings in 1859. And he wrote a paper about it. And he was actually the first one to figure out that it can't be a solid disk. It can't be made of all the same stuff that's connected together. He figured out that it has to be made up of a bunch of small pieces. And he worked out the math, figured it out. And he wrote a paper about it. And in the introduction of that paper, he wrote three paragraphs that I found particularly striking. It's a beautiful quote, not just about the rings of Saturn, but basically about why we do science. Yes, some mysteries of our universe might unlock physics, and some might not. But we're going to study them all because we're curious. I'll let Maxwell describe. And by the way, further on, I don't want to interrupt the quote because it flows very nicely. He's actually a really good writer. He mentioned something called spiral nebula. What he's referring to is what we now know as the spiral galaxies. And you'll see when it appears in the quote, just keep that in mind. He mentions them in a certain kind of context, and wouldn't he be surprised what the spiral nebula actually turned out to be. So here's James Clerk Maxwell, 1859, writing in his own words about why he was interested in Saturn, but largely why we do science. So here he is. There are some questions in astronomy to which we are attracted rather on account of their peculiarity as the possible illustration of some unknown principle than from any direct advantage which their solution would afford to mankind. I am not aware that any practical use has been made of Saturn's rings, either in astronomy or in navigation. They are too distant and too insignificant in mass to produce any appreciable effect on the motion of other parts of the solar system. But when we contemplate the rings from a purely scientific point of view, they become the most remarkable bodies in the heavens, except perhaps those still less useful bodies, the spiral nebula. When we have actually seen that great arch swung over the equator of the planet without any visible connection, we cannot bring our minds to rest. We cannot simply admit that such is the case and describe it as one of the observed facts of nature, not admitting or requiring explanation. We must either explain its motion on the principles of mechanics or admit that, in the realms of Saturn, there can be motion regulated by laws which we are unable to explain. So there you go. We do science because, I love that snippet, because we cannot bring our minds to rest. By the way, if you want my episodes to be nothing but reading aloud James Clerk Maxwell, you can contribute to patreon.com/PM Sutter. If you want me to not quote anybody at all, you can contribute to patreon.com/PM Sutter. And if you want me to make up quotes from imaginary people on the spot as I go to do my recordings, make your voice heard by contributing to patreon.com/PMSire. And don't forget, we're going to Iceland together to check out some aurora, astrotouring.com. Big thanks to my top Patreon contributors this week: Helge B, Justin G, Justin R, Jerry, Kevin O, and Jessica K. Join the party, patreon.com/PMSire, and I'll quote James Clerk Maxwell all day long. Thank you so much to Jamal for asking today's question. You can ask more. Hashtag Ask a Spaceman, askaspaceman.com, youtube.com/c/PaulMatsar. Also follow me on Twitter and Facebook at Paul Matsar. And don't forget, there is a new radio show that I will be hosting in addition to this podcast. And I need to know from you whether to host the podcast version, the recording of that radio show on this same feed, or make it its own feed that you separately subscribe to. Let me know any way you can, and I will see you next time for more Complete Knowledge of Time and Space.